IllbeHonest.com.
We have just been singing about Christ and the cross. And I believe that what God has given me to speak on tonight is, in a way, far afield from that, but in another way, close to home. I'd like to speak to you on the subject of parenting. And let's read in Titus chapter 2, verse 4, or verse 3. Older women likewise are to be reverent in their behavior, not malicious gossips, nor enslaved to much wine, teaching what is good, so that they may encourage, that is, teach, train, the young women to love their husbands, to love their children. My point is, it is scriptural to teach on parenting, so that they may encourage, teach, train, the young women, young men, anyone, to love their children. I know that many books have been written on the subject, but I also know there's a lot in the Bible about the subject. And as I say, it does get pretty close to home. And there are things that we can learn. I don't presume or suggest or any idea that I'm going to give you any exhaustive treatment on it, but only a few points that I have observed. And I'll do somewhat like Brother Pelkey did this morning, turn to a few different references, but not be speaking too long on any of them. My first point is in Psalm 127. Psalm 127. And that is that children can be a tremendous blessing, and parenting can be a tremendous blessing. It says in Psalm 127, verse 5, how blessed is the man whose quiver is full of them. And in 128, verse 4, for thus shall the man be blessed who fears the Lord. In both cases, it is talking about children. Children can be a blessing. What fun they can be, what joy they can be, what friends they can be, what fellowship they can afford, what helpers they can be. It says in verse 4, 127, verse 4, they are like arrows. It does not say crooked sticks. It says arrows. And that speaks of warfare. In 128, verse 3, it says like olive plants. It does not say weeds. And that speaks of fruitfulness. Children can be such a blessing, I'm saying. John says, there is no greater joy I have than this, and to hear that my children are walking in the truth. I remember when Terry and I had just been engaged, Conrad Merle was speaking there in Kirksville when we still lived in Kirksville. That's where we were engaged, that's where we were married, and we thought we'd better get some time with this man of God and ask him if he could tell us something about marriage and about parenting. And he said, well, Terry, if you have something against Bob, you tell him, and Bob the same way for you. And number two, he says, we want to see some children. We thought we were going to hear something really deep, profound, that what he gave us was deep and profound. And so we took his advice, and 11 months later, our firstborn was born. Children can be such a blessing. But my second point is from Proverbs chapter 10, and that is that children can be a curse. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 1. The Proverbs of Solomon, a wise son makes a father glad, but a foolish son is a grief to his mother. Gladness versus grief. And in Psalm or Proverbs 17, it says that such a son is a grief to the father as well. Both father, both mother, a grief. There are about 13 verses in the book of Proverbs that read like this, talking about the blessings and the curse of either a wise son or a foolish son. Isaac had an Esau who was a grief to him. Eli had a Hophni and a Phinehas. They were a grief. Samuel had a Joel and an Abijah, and they were a grief to him. David had an Absalom and an Adonijah, and they were a grief to him. Hezekiah had a Manasseh, and he was a grief to that godly man. And Jehoshaphat had a Jehoram, and he was a grief to him. Billy Sunday, a preacher in the 1920s or so, probably put more taverns out of business than any other preacher, and yet he had, I believe it was two sons that were drunkards themselves. A grief. A grief to the parents, they can be a grief to a church. I think that one of the big sources of leaven in a church can be unregenerate children. Here's a new church starting out, and the parents are fresh converted. They've freshly seen the sinfulness of sin. They've freshly seen the glory of God. They're all excited to make their lives different, and they put out this, and they throw out that, and they make straight paths for the Lord, and everything fresh and new and wonderful. And then the children come along, and they're not born again. And dad and mom, can't we do this? And why must we do that? And so the pressure is on. And the parents began to compromise a little here and a little there. You know, if we don't, we're going to lose them. And eventually the leaven sets in on that church and it goes down and down and out. And the Lord Jesus said that it'd be better for a man never to be born than to end up in hell. He didn't say it'd be like he'd never been born. That's annihilationism. He said it's better if he'd never been born. I'm saying that children can be a curse. They can be a grief. Ultimately, we are shut up to the grace of God. Let me say this at the start. We are cast upon the grace of God when everything is said and done. Salvation is of the Lord. And how many we can look around and see, we can see ungodly parents, and they have godly children. There's several in the church that I pastor here. This one fellow, he is a solid Christian, but his parents were ungodly. His father was a drunk. On the other hand, you can look around and you can see godly parents and their children have gone astray. And so I'm saying, yes, ultimately we are cast upon the grace of God. But having acknowledged that, nevertheless, on the other hand, we can acknowledge that the Bible does give us certain things that can be done, that are general promises. For example, Proverbs 22, train up a child in the way that he should go, and afterward he will not depart from it. I don't believe that's a just... I believe there are promises like that that are general promises that we ought to lay hold of, walk in the light of them if we can. There are some things that can be done. For example, in the examples that I just gave you, you can see there were some things that the parents did wrong. I mean, David erred with his boys. He was a great musician, he was a great statesman, he was a great warrior, but he blew it as a father. Old Eli, there were things that he did wrong. Samuel, old Samuel, that man of God, it says when he got old, he appointed his boys to be judges, and it says they did not walk in his ways, they loved money. They went after unrighteous gain and bribes. Now, that old prophet should have known better. He should have known their character. What was he doing, putting his boys in a position of authority? So I have about five or six things that have been special to me, and that I would like to try to highlight them to you, that it might be profitable somehow, some way, for young, for old, grandparents, parents, children, future parents, all of us. It first in Proverbs 29, verse 15. Proverbs 29, verse 15. It says, "The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child who gets his own way brings shame to his mother." Why does it say mother? I don't know. Maybe it's because the mother is with the children the most, and in a sense, she has the greatest opportunity for input. A lot of times we think, well, if the child isn't disciplined correctly, why, it's going to hurt him. Yeah, but here it brings out the thought that it's going to hurt the mother, it's going to hurt the parents. You spare the child the pain and you're going to reap the pain yourself, mothers, fathers. In contrast, verse 17, it says, "Correct your son and he will give you comfort." In contrast to verse 15, the shame. "He will delight your soul." But let's look at the first part of this second phrase. A child who gets his own way, that's the thing that's being brought out here. A child who gets his own way. You know, parents, that you can teach your children many things. You can teach your children how to tie their shoes. You can teach them how to bat a ball. You can teach them how to keep a checkbook. You can teach them how to drive a car. But if you don't teach them that they don't have to have their way, you're missing it miserably. If you don't teach them that they're not the cutest thing on the block, if you don't teach them that they're not the center of the universe, if you don't teach them that they're not sovereign, if you don't teach them how to deny themselves, how to humble themselves, that they don't have to have their own way, you're going to fail them miserably. You see, that pride that remains from failing to break the will, the self-will of the child, that remaining pride, that is going to hurt him throughout his life. It's going to hurt him in the schoolroom. It's going to hurt him on the job. It's going to hurt him in relationships everywhere. And it's going to be the biggest obstacle to him ever getting into heaven. Because the Lord said, if a man will come after me, he's going to have to deny himself. He's going to have to come to the place where he realizes, not my will, but God's be done. That self-will must be broken. And a lot of parents are afraid right there at that point to tackle that very thing. And you see, David, that's where he missed it. It says in 1 Kings chapter 1, verse 5, that David never did cross Adonijah at any time. It says in the margin, he never pained him at any time. He never crossed him. What? He never crossed him? That's right. He was a lot of children, it appears, a lot of parents are afraid of their own children. Yes. They think, if I cross my child, I'm going to lose him. But the truth of the matter is, you're going to lose him anyway. They're afraid to call that bluff. They're afraid to cross their children, and they end up letting their children run the household. They end up letting the children determine when we will do this, where we will go, if we will go, and all that type of thing. Incredible reversal. You see, we parents, we can keep our children away from this evil influence. We can keep them out of that evil influence. We can keep them out of the public schools, and we can homeschool them and do all of that. But if we don't teach our children this right here, we have become the worst influence they'll ever encounter. We. I see parents with young teenagers, they're homeschooling them, and yet the going is tough and the child is bucking and fighting. And you feel like telling the parents, just let him go to public school. You've already lost the battle. Let the public school be the enemy rather than you. It can't get any worse than what it is. When you've got hell on at home. There's a promise right here. It says the rod and reproof. Give wisdom. There's a promise here that there is some means that are effectual. Now, the reproof. It's good to give reproof first. It gives you an opportunity to cool down, for one thing. And it's only reasonable to give reasons why you're going to have to spank them. And then it says a rod. It does not say the hand. That's too personal. That's too intimate. Get a rod. Something that does not hurt them. I like a little plastic ball bat. That's what we liked. It really stings. It doesn't hurt them, but it sure does sting. It is possible to convince that child that it is not worth it to do this thing anymore. It just doesn't pay. And a lot of parents, you know, they go with a 20 swats. And it doesn't do any. All you're doing is exasperating the child. You never do get deep enough to get the job done. The old man has to be toppled, humbled. It's amazing that, you know, people know how to break a horse, but they don't give the same courage and diligence to break their child. They know how to train a dog, but they don't train their child. How inconsistent, how stupid. How unthinking. My father, I can remember one time I was a teenager and we got back from church and we're sitting around the table and some tension arose. And I said something very disrespectful to my mother. And my mother went to slap me. And as a reaction, I raised my hand with a fork in my hand. And the fork went right into her hand and stuck there. And so she went to the bedroom and was there for a while. And my father said, Bob, don't you believe you better go and apologize to your mother. I'm so glad he did. My father was not a Christian, but I am thankful that he was, in a sense, an upright man, a decent man. I'm glad for every time that he reproved me. I remember one time as I was probably about 18 years old, I was playing softball for the town, and I struck out. The umpire called me out, and it was a neighbor farmer who was doing the umpiring, and I didn't think he called it right, and I turned around and threw my bat down. And when I got home, my father said, Bob, he says, it's one thing to strike out. That's okay. But when you threw your bat down, you sure looked like a weak sister. And I didn't sleep for a while that night. I felt about 1 inch tall. Another time, my brother and I were in 4-H, and it was time to do the record books and get them turned in. And it was an old, hot August summer day. We were sitting at the kitchen table. My father was at the end of the table. I was over here. My brother was over there. And we had not been diligent in our business. Everything was haywire. It was a mess. And you couldn't figure out what we had done, as far as the records of those calves. And our attitude was rotten. And one of us made some sour comment. My father backhanded us both. Bang, bang. And business picked up. I'm not saying that that's exactly right, but I'm just saying I'm looking back on it, and I'm glad he did. We deserved it. We deserved it. We ought to spank discipline for bad attitudes, not just actions. My first point is the self-will must be humbled. I hope you got it. I hope you got it. A second point is in 1 Samuel chapter 2. And that my point here is we need to mean what we say. This is the case of Eli with his boys who are committing immorality right there in the tabernacle. It says in 2:13, I had told him that I am about to judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knew, because his sons brought a curse on themselves and he did not rebuke them. He did not rebuke them. Look over here in chapter 2, verse 23. He says, Eli says, why do you do such things, the evil things that I hear from all these people? No, my sons, for the report is not good which I hear the Lord's people circulating, and so on. It says over here, Eli didn't rebuke them. Well, over here, it sounds like he did. How do you reconcile it? I believe the answer is this. He didn't say it hard enough. He didn't mean what he said. You better mean what you say. Do not give a command ever that you're not willing to enforce, that you're not willing to back up. Even little things. You know, telling your child to go to say hi to Grandpa. Tell him thank you now for this and that. Don't give a command, even little things, that you're not willing to back up. It makes a liar out of you. You throw away your authority just like that as a parent. You better mean what you say. A lot of times parents will give a command, and the way they say it leaves a crack in the door. The child can sense that there's an option. The child can sense that he didn't really mean it. There's a way to say it and really mean it and speak it firmly. Next, Colossians chapter 3. Colossians 3, verse 21. Fathers, do not exasperate your children so that they will not lose heart. You know, you've probably wondered, why doesn't it say children? Do not exasperate your parents. But fathers, don't exasperate your children. That's what we've got. How can we exasperate the children? Here's a few thoughts. One way is by hypocrisy. I know of a fellow that he was old covenant theology. And he said to the children, you can play with toys on Sunday, on the Lord's Day, but it has to be religious toys, you know, like a little Noah's Ark and so on. I mean, even the children can see through that false doctrine. Another way is by disciplining them inconsistently or erratically or selfishly or meanly. You know, here's Saul. He says to Jonathan, his son, you son of a perverse woman. What kind of language is that? You don't want to wound, injure, hurt their spirit. You want them to know that they are dearly beloved. There is nothing apart from the Lord Himself that is more important to you than they are. They are very precious to you. And so many little things can exasperate the children. One time when the church was still meeting in our house, there was someone who stayed, she stayed long. She was hungry for fellowship, and sometimes she didn't leave till 5 in the afternoon. And so it got to be about 5 o'clock, and the conversation went on. And our 1.5-year-old son, he got just fed up with the whole thing, no attention, and he finally urinated on the wood stove. So again, business picked up. But I mean, he was exasperated. You know, this is ridiculous. He saw through it better than we did, and he took action. One time I was at a Christian's household and staying overnight, and the breakfast was set on, and the call was made for breakfast. And so here the whole family gathers around, and here the father has this devotional. I mean, and it was a long devotional. While the breakfast sat there getting cold. You know, maybe that's what it means in Ecclesiastes, do not be overly righteous. But, you know, you could just feel it. The children were sitting there exasperated. Well, what good is this spiritual activity when that's going on down deep? And I've seen also people hang around after a meeting. And, they're standing there talking about spiritual things, you know, talking about the things of God. But all the while, after 2 hours, you know, their children are going nuts. They're beside themselves. And so, you know, you feel sorry for the children. And so, fathers, do not exasperate your children. Next is Hebrews chapter 12. Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 10. For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them. That's about all we can do. Do the best you can. And even with what I'm giving you here tonight, you know, you've got to sort it all out and do what seems best to you. But He, God, disciplines us for our good so that we might share in His holiness. My point is we should do what we can to maintain a spirit of discipline in the household. It says in 2 Timothy chapter 1, verse 7, that God has given us not a spirit of fear, but what? Power, a spirit of love, a spirit of discipline. That's the way the New American reads. A spirit of discipline. So to have a disciplined spirit about your household, that's not an ungodly thing. That's not a legalistic thing. That's a godly thing. God is a God of discipline, a God of order, not of confusion. Do what you can to have a spirit of discipline about your household. So many parents, they pet their children, they pamper their children, they let their children fuss and whine and talk baby talk to them way beyond the ears. Do what you can to maintain a spirit of discipline. I know of one family that had several sons, and they pet and they pampered this one son, and that son turned out to be a homosexual. Make meal times as much as possible. Set meal times as much as possible. Set a breakfast time if it's possible. I mean, expect the children to be there. If they can't make it, if they're having trouble to make it, they can go to bed earlier. If they don't make it, don't bring breakfast out for them at 10 o'clock in the morning. They missed it. Have a spirit of discipline in your household. It will do them good for years to come. My next point is in Genesis 24. What is it? Number 5, maybe? Genesis 24. And that is, teach your children the joy of hard work, the blessings of hard work, as seen in the case here with Rebekah. You remember Abraham sent his servant out to get a wife for his son Isaac. And the servant prays in verse 14, "Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, 'Please let down your jar so that I may drink,' and who answers, 'Drink, and I will water your camels also,' may she be the one whom you have appointed for your servant Isaac." And so, we come to verse 19. "Now when she had finished giving him a drink, she said, 'I will draw also for your camels until they have finished drinking.'" Do you realize the reason that this young lady, Rebekah, was honored was because she had an also in her life. She not only gave the servant water, but she says, "I'll water your camels also." She had an also in her life, a second mile attitude in her life. She not only got water for the camels, but it says in verse 20, she ran for it. It's amazing how many children, they know how to hustle on the ball field, but they don't know how to hustle in the workplace. I grew up on a farm. Sometimes it was necessary to hire some extra help. My dad sometimes hired classmates of mine, and it got to be kind of a family joke how that so often the athletes, they didn't know how to work. And I remember one time I was with a mission group over in Europe, and this fellow was from Montana, grew up on a ranch, and he said it was my uncle that taught me how to work. That phrase just stuck in my mind. Taught me how to work. If it is possible, and it may not be, but if it is possible, start some kind of a home industry where your children can learn. They can learn the rewards of diligence and the disadvantage of laziness, where they can learn the value of time, where they can learn the value of money, that it isn't just given to them, where they can learn the value of being industrious. You know, Jeroboam, he admittedly turned out to be no good religiously, but Solomon exalted him because he saw that Jeroboam was industrious. And so it is a great virtue to learn to work hard and to enjoy it. Some people can get things done while the other fellow is just standing there looking at how it could be done. I remember my father telling me time and again, "Bob, do I have to tell you every move to make?" And he was right. I mean, it came from, of course, a bad attitude. Josh McDowell, he said, probably the number one sin of teenagers is wasting time. A sixth point is in Psalm 128. We're going back to the Psalm 128. But so much of that idleness, it can be redeemed if you've got some job to do, some home industry there. Teach the children that they are needed. I mean that they are needed. You know, it's just, sure, it's easier at first to do it yourself. But eventually it's profitable when the child can do it. Let them know that they are really meeting a need in the family. It is a joy to them. My next point I see is Psalm 128. I'm kind of stretching this one, admittedly, but in verse 3 it says, "Your children will be like olive plants around your table." My point here is that do what you can to have your meals together. Teenagers too. There's no reason they can't pretty well take their meals with you. Do what you can to have your meals together. Let that meal time, let that table be a love feast every time. Let it be an opportunity for sharing your joys and your burdens, your concerns, your plans, your ambitions, your wishes with one another. Let that table be an opportunity for seminary when you can tell them about the sinfulness of sin and the beauties of holiness, when you can talk to them about the statutes of God. That mealtime, that can be a very special time. That's one thing that is so vanished in our culture today. Take your meals together. My next is from Psalm 133. Turn over a page. Psalm 133, and I'm stretching it here again. But it says in verse 1, "How good and pleasant it is for the brothers to dwell together in unity." If that's true for the brethren, of course it's true for husband and wife, mother and father. If those children see the father acting arrogantly, the mother acting with insubordinance, if they see that tension and that fighting going on, well, you know you've opened a crack, you've opened a door for them to do the same thing. I mean, mom and dad, you're doing it. Why should I try to be any different? Don't be a hypocrite. You're doing it. Why do you tell me not to do that? But if father and mother are in unity, I mean, if they are in one spirit, that is a powerful influence in that home. My last point is Psalm 34. Psalm 34, verse 11. "Come, you children, listen to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord." When all is said and done, you could sum it up this way. We want to teach our children the fear of the Lord. We want to teach them that there is a God who is there. We want to teach them that He is supreme. We want to teach them that He is supremely important in our life. We want to teach our children that we must center our lives around Him, that He sees everything, that He knows everything, that He will judge everything. We want to teach our children that the flesh is weak and that time is short, death is certain, judgment is coming. There's a heaven to gain, there's a hell to shun, there's a Savior to win. Be reconciled to God. Lay hold on the Lord Jesus Christ. We want to teach them the sinfulness of sin and the beauty of holiness. We want to teach them the glorious gospel of the blessed God. Everything is centered around the Lord Jesus Christ. And one of the most important things is by example. I mean, your life, your example, your daily choices will speak far louder than what comes out of your mouth. If you go to the ball game instead of going to the church meeting, they've got the message. And that is that when push comes to shove and there's a tension, and you choose that rather than the things of God, they know that the Lord isn't all that important after all to you. You better teach them the fear of the Lord. I said at the beginning, we're shut up to the grace of God in the final analysis. And that's what we got to do, is come boldly to the throne of grace for our children. Maybe some of you have read the book Fresh Wind, Fresh Fire, the Jim Cimbala. He tells in there how that his daughter went astray, got off into drugs, and disappeared. They didn't know where she was. They knew she was in the gutter. And he never did tell the church, never did call the church for prayer. He didn't want to burden them. And the church was pretty big by this time, several hundred. They were meeting for prayer on a Tuesday night. And as the pastor was bent over in prayer, someone came and put a note under his nose. "Pastor, don't you think you'd better call the church to pray for your daughter?" And he did. And he said it was like waves of intercession came over that prayer meeting. A few days later, in the morning, he was upstairs shaving, and that daughter appeared. And the mother hollered up the stairs. She said, "Jim, our daughter is back." He went running downstairs with the shaving cream on his face, and his daughter fell at his feet and said, "Dad, just tell me who was praying for me Tuesday night." She was saved by the grace of God right there. I'm talking about coming to the throne of grace for our children. My wife Terry was at some friends in Iowa some years back before we were married. Baylor Zupkes, some of you know them. And a godly family. And here, one of their sons, when he graduated from high school, he rebelled openly, ridiculously, publicly. I mean, it was a type of thing where you couldn't imagine that that would happen. And the Zupkes, they own a sand and gravel business, pretty good sized. And they called a fast. They set business aside. They shut down. And they went to fasting and praying for maybe 2 or 3 days, was it? Until the Lord gave the mother a word that their son would be saved. 2 years later, that son Sam was saved in the military over in Europe. And he's gone on with God since. Keith McLeod, a prophet of God from Canada, he's now with the Lord. I remember him telling me one time that some years before, he had one son who was yet outside the kingdom. And it came to a place where he prayed, "Lord, whatever it takes, would you save my son Douglas?" And that very night, Douglas came in about 10:30, came in the house. He'd been out on the streets. And his so-called friends had turned against him and beat him to a pulp so bad that Keith said he could hardly recognize him. But it was that right there that set him to seeking God, and he's walked with God since. May the Lord help us to know the joy, the supreme joy of our children, all of them, walking in the truth.